Our second case for this morning is Aylshire v. Harris, 12-17-35. And when you're ready, Ms. Thalman. We'll hear you.
May it please the Court. We agree that 15 U.S.C. 1681 S2A does not confer a private right of action under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The question is whether the state claims, and there are three of them here, are preempted by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. We disagree with the conclusion that all state claims are preempted if they're related to, quote, any subject matter regulated under 1681 S2 relating to the responsibilities of persons who furnish information to consumers.
That's 1681 TB1 capital F, right? And I'm very curious how you propose to distinguish our Purcell decision, or whether you're just here to ask us to consider this en banc and overrule it.
Well, I do disagree with the holding in Purcell, but I believe there is another distinction that wasn't discussed at all in Purcell, and that is that section that you just cited, 1681 TB.
B1F.
Yes, specifically states that no requirement or prohibition may be imposed under the laws of any state. Now, assuming there's no distinction between state statutory and common law, which you clearly held in Purcell, and I'm not going to argue otherwise, the question becomes whether any action or proceeding in the nature of the three things identified, defamation, invasion of privacy, or negligence with respect to the false reporting, is in fact a requirement or prohibition under Illinois law. And I suggest that they are not requirements or prohibitions as TB, as that subsection requires.
You know, the issue I have with that is that there's a fairly long line of cases in the Supreme Court dealing with when is background state common law, tort law usually, something that is preempted by a regulatory regime that imposes standards of care. Sometimes it's, you know, Cipollone and cigarette safety, and sometimes it's been medical devices, and sometimes it's been other things. But the court regularly considers the state tort law or the state common law to be in the nature of a requirement or prohibition. It's just that sometimes Congress has savings clauses in the statutes that say state law continues to operate, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think you're fighting an uphill battle to say that state common law actions somehow don't qualify. They are, in fact, requirements about the duty of care that you're supposed to exercise. They're requirements about causation. It's just not
the
so many words.
I understand what you're saying, but the crux of the 1996 addition was really that state and federal agencies be able to regulate these types of cases. And to me, to say we're going to regulate conduct is different from saying, but if there is a violation, there are damages available. And I don't think you can reconcile, which you attempted to do in Purcell, these two provisions, unless you make a distinction between regulation, prohibition, and then damages if something is violated. And I think that is the distinction. The distinction this court, with all due respect.
What case has done that? What cases can we follow to reach that?
I could not find a case that specifically addressed that issue, but it sort of gets to, it's related to the argument that I brought forth in my brief. Again, I was not trying to say that to counter Erie or its progeny or anything like that. But if we look at the statutory language and the statutory enactment, there has to be a way, if this court believes that both provisions should be in effect, to reconcile them. The way this court did so in Purcell is really, I think, with all due respect, very poorly thought out.
You didn't cite Purcell, did you?
I did not.
That's,
I did not, because
that
I don't.
Would have been a good start.
It would have, although I don't think it's dispositive here.
But it's certainly on point. I mean, really.
Yes, it is. It is, but it's not dispositive.
But see, here's the problem, I think, with your argument. When we have a statutory structure, whether it's in the credit reporting area or any other area, that imposes certain regulatory requirements on the set of people who are regulated, then they would like to be able to look at those regulations and see what they're required to do. Now, if you have off there in left field tort law that is also, in a sense, a possible source of liability, they don't have that legal certainty that they would have if the regulations were exclusively there. So it's certainly the case that tort law regulates somehow. And if this is saying we're not going to let the states regulate, whether by statute or rule or common law, these subject matters, this language here with this weird Massachusetts and California exception, that's pretty clear to me. I mean, Congress has made a choice. Congress sometimes makes a choice to say there won't be private rights of action. We want, you know, the Federal Reserve Board, or we want the FTC, or we want the Consumer Product Safety Commission, or somebody looking at things, the FDA sometimes. So, you know, whether we like that as a policy matter or not is kind of beside the point. Congress creates remedial structures.
I think there's a real difference between federal agencies interpreting the statute and so forth, which courts would, of course, look to. But we're dealing with specific state law causes of action. Defamation. Defamation would have nothing to do.
It's not a requirement or prohibition.
Right. It would have, and not only that, it would have nothing to do, would have no impact on or effect on a state or federal agency regulating under this act.
I don't know what.
I want to clarify something. That's just the underlying problem. There were five houses or five properties.
Correct.
Credit rating, I guess, declared that they were what, underwater? They were worth less than was owed, or something like that.
Because of the improper reporting, it was actually reported as an unlimited line of credit.
That's this 999999999 credit. So the computer just threw in nines.
They did, and what that did
was an error. You're talking about something I'm not familiar with. I look at credit ratings. I just wondered if the examiners and other people come into banks and stuff and say, you know, this is not a viable credit loan. That's not what happened, apparently.
No, what happened to her, as I understand it, is when Harris took over the local bank, the Villa Park Bank, she had five loans, and they erroneously reported it as 10,
right.
Which suggested that she was far more exposed than she really was, and they made the other mistake of putting the wrong numbers.
No,
it was their error that caused horrendous financial loss. Whether,
is she in bankruptcy now, by the way?
There have been bankruptcies filed. I don't know what the current status.
The reason I'm asking is I just wondered whether there's any automatic stay in place and whether this court ought to be going forward if this matter is before the bankruptcy court. I don't know.
She was in bankruptcy during the pendency of the underlying federal case. I don't recall what the posture was, whether we specifically, yeah, I was the fourth attorney, received permission from the court to proceed on this.
Permission was given to proceed?
I'm saying I do not know.
I would appreciate it if you could give us a statement after oral argument letting us know what her status is vis-a-vis bankruptcy. There was a passing remark about it that caused me to think maybe that was there. And if there was an order of the bankruptcy court lifting the automatic stay for this, then fine. You know, that happens. But I don't want this to be procedurally irregular.
You're absolutely right. I'll provide a supplemental statement on that.
Including whether these claims were listed in bankruptcy.
I am sure they were listed in bankruptcy.
But please verify that.
Yeah.
In your statement.
So jumping ahead a little bit, claim about the denial of the opportunity to file a third amended complaint. That would have been the fourth complaint?
The fourth complaint.
And isn't enough after a point for the district judge?
Yeah, of course, the court has discretion. And the question is, did the court abuse its discretion in this case? I think it did because there were no new facts. There was no indication that there would have been any prejudice to the other side. There was nothing really that would be changed about the case other than the potential causes of action. And
but you don't want to minimize that. I mean, that was actually one of the reasons the district judge said enough is enough.
It seems to be kind of this mercurial theory that every time
it's true. This is a complicated area. Perhaps because she had several attorneys, people had different viewpoints as to how to best proceed for her. You know, personally, I believe...
Like it's a difficult situation looking for a theory.
Yes.
Rest on one.
Right. It was indeed. And I don't think the court gave that due deference, and particularly because there would have been absolutely no negative impact upon the parties.
Initially was filed in 2008. The claim was initially filed in 2008.
Let's see. I think that's correct. There was about a year and a half, I believe, between the amendments of the complaint is what I recall.
You can look at it. If you'd like to save a minute for rebuttal, you can fill in that answer when you come back.
Thank you. The biggest problem I have is that both 1681HE and 1681TB deal with the same issue. They both deal and concern the reporting or misreporting, inaccurate reporting of credit information. HE speaks about an action or proceeding brought by a consumer with respect to the reporting of credit information. 1681TB states that no requirement or prohibition may be imposed with respect to the responsibilities who furnish information to consumer reporting agencies. These address the same things. How does the court rationally deal with these two provisions? And I suggest that what I have set forth in my brief in terms of legislative...
Okay, we have that point. You are, in fact, almost finished with your rebuttal, so...
Okay. If there are no further questions, I will sit down.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Seip.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Todd Seip, or Stephen Todd Seip, on behalf of the appellee, Harris Bank. Respect to the Purcell case.
They're BMO Harris these days, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, we're BMO Harris Bank N.A., specifically. With respect to the Purcell case, we think it's right on point.
So this is a situation. It's actually a very sad case because the bank completely failed to do anything right for Ms. Elsher, and it may be that the Fair Credit Reporting Act is so bank-friendly that there's nothing that anybody can do about it, but they essentially ruined this poor woman by their errors in the report, you know, how many loans are there and what's the line of credit, and of course she doesn't look worthy of a huge inflated line of credit, even though she would have been okay under the correct one. It's a very sad case.
Well, it's a sad case if the allegations were actually true.
Well, we take them to be true at this
point.
I know
you do take them to be true, but it's a bit frustrating in this case because I don't think I've worked on one where the allegations were so at odds with what actually happened. But I understand we're on a motion to dismiss, and we take the allegations
as they are.
And like I said, I think the Purcell case is on point. The claims that were in that case were the same claims that were alleged here: defamation, invasion of privacy, and negligence. So I don't think it could be any more on point. And since Purcell was decided, the Second Circuit as well cited Purcell and applied its reasoning as well. Respect to the amendment issue, the denial of the motion to amend, a couple things I want to point out that were mentioned. One is that there was an assertion that there would be no change in the case. I want to point out that at that point there had been three complaints, two dismissal orders, and the second dismissal order effectively terminated all of the claims relating to these credit reporting issues. And that happened, the dismissal order happened 13 months before the motion for leave to amend. After the second dismissal order, that would be May 2010, the only claim that remained in the case was one that had nothing to do with these credit reporting issues that you'd mentioned, but rather was a single discrete issue about Harris reviewing plaintiff's credit report in May of 2009. That was the only claim that had been in the case for 13 months. During that 13 months, there had been discovery on that claim. There had been discovery close dates that had passed. There had been a number of changes in attorney on plaintiff's side. So there was a whole large lag of time between the second dismissal order and the third complaint and the fourth proposed complaint. And I wanted the state that in the fourth complaint that was proposed, the claims were based on essentially the same facts that had been in all the other complaints. There were some more details, but they're essentially the same facts. And during the oral argument on that motion, plaintiff's counsel conceded that all the facts, all the allegations that had been set forth in that proposed complaint were known from the very start of the case. And Judge Coleman, in her order, noted that this wasn't a situation where new facts came to light. It was basically throwing a third legal theory based on the same facts.
Let me ask you another question. There were a number of different credit reports issued over the period of time she's complaining about, right? It's my recollection from the record that her credit score keeps going down.
I don't believe that's the case. I think what happened here was that there was an error in her credit report in 2006. I don't recall.
But there's a final report. There's at least another one, August 3, 2009. Maybe there's some others in between. But I think that her credit score itself went down as time went on. And the reason that's interesting to me is that if for some reason we decided Purcell didn't apply, it seems to me like a different report would give rise to a different cause of action for defamation and would bear on the statute of limitations point.
It was true, and I think that was brought up in the opinion by the Seventh Circuit in Huckick. So the statute of limitations argument has some issues to it, but
if
I don't think we get there.
Maybe we don't. If it's successive reports saying exactly the same thing, that might be one thing. But if it's actually different reports with different scores, you would agree, I hope, that
I believe that that's what the Huckett case held. I'm not sure. I get mixed up in my head what actually happened versus what's in the complaint, and I can't remember what the allegation was specifically on that. Respect to, I don't think we get there, but I think we don't get to the statute of limitations also because a number of these claims don't have, are facially invalid as well. For example, there's a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim, and this court has held repeatedly that under Illinois law that requires a physical impact. That's not alleged here, and none of those Seventh Circuit cases are mentioned in the plaintiff's brief. There's a defamation per se claim. We have authority from this court as well as the Northern District Court that doesn't apply as well. The only argument that is made in their brief is essentially conceding that it's not defamation per se, but saying that the district court erred in not treating it as a different claim, defamation per quad. But the problem with that is that it was alleged as defamation per se. It was argued as defamation per se, so there was no basis for the court to treat it any differently than what the plaintiff actually argued. So I think that we don't need to get to the merits because I think of preemption, but as we pointed out in some detail in our brief, there were problems even with the substance of the claims themselves. And we think that the court, we set out a long, detailed, tortured history of this case in the brief, and we think that the court also acted appropriately in denying a fourth complaint 30 months after the case had started.
Are you familiar with the bankruptcy status with respect to these?
I believe that the bankruptcy has been dismissed, but I am not 100% sure. I have not worked on the bankruptcy case. But I believe I've been told from bankruptcy counsel that it's been dismissed, but we'll have to check that because I haven't worked on the bankruptcy itself. And so I would ask that the ruling be affirmed by the district court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Seid. And you have about a minute, Ms. Bellman.
Your Honor is correct that it was originally filed in 2008, and I believe in Appley's brief they do go through the timing of the various amendments and so forth, and I would rely on that, that is accurate. There are two cases that support support remand in this case. And the first is the Hushik case versus Aurora Loan Services. That's this court's opinion. And this court recognized that plaintiff's defamation claim was not preempted by 1681H. Because malice was in fact alleged. Now,
well, some
what
claims,
they didn't
some claims
say,
there were not premised on credit reporting. But anyway, you need to wrap up.
Yes,
your time is up.
But what this court did not say is that the defamation claim was preempted.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.